We will move on to our second case of this morning, National Labor Relations Board against KSM Industries, number 10-3300. Mr. Kinney.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, I'm Kevin Kinney. I represent the respondent KSM Industries in this matter. Generally speaking, there are certain facts that are background, but not at all in dispute. In January of 1997, there was a strike at KSM Industries. In October of 97, the strike ended. 4 years later, the Labor Board determined that approximately 3 or 4 months after the strike began, it had been converted into an unfair labor practice strike.
I have to comment, Mr. Kinney, that one thing that comes out of this case is the appalling length of time these cases take to unfold. I mean, some of us barely remember 1997.
As I do, too. Your Honor, I couldn't agree more with you. It is unbelievable how long these cases take to get processed. I can tell you why. It's not in the record, but I can certainly tell you why. Except for one time, okay? And that was on the remand in this case, okay? This case actually was decided by the board. It went to the D.C. Court of Appeals.
The D.C. Circuit, you mean?
Excuse me. Yeah, the D.C. Circuit. And again, I'm jumping a little ahead of myself here, but when that case went to the D.C. Court of Appeals, D.C. Circuit, and it got remanded on September 29th, the new board, the new panel was first impaneled, then they reviewed a 1,348-page record, 160 exhibits, several hundred pages of briefs. And then the next day, they issued this decision that.
But you know, as the union points out in its amicus brief, and this thought had crossed my mind anyway, new process was hardly a surprise to anybody, and that decision had been handed down some months before. The board knew that it had a monumental task, not just in your case, but in many, many cases. So I don't see any reason to think that they sat down and did seven cases in a 24-hour period of time. If I had been on the board, I certainly would have been spacing the work out from the day that new process came down. And I don't think this court is entitled to presume administrative irregularities, such as lies, in the statement that we've considered the record.
You know, when I look at it, Your Honor, did they start working on it earlier? I don't know.
Well, that's the whole point. We don't know. There certainly was plenty of time to work on this case as well as there are many other cases from the time new process came down.
It would be difficult to understand, though, how they got a panel on the case, though, at that time. I think that's a gap in that argument, though, to look at the case. If you think about it, you know, maybe someone looked at it. Your Honor, what's really troubling, though, is, you know, I've done a lot of these labor board cases, and it's always difficult when your client looks at you and says, do you think they even looked at it? Okay? And the fact of the matter is,
I say this, Mr. Kinney, but some people even say that about the Court of Appeals. Do you think they really read the briefs? I can assure you that we have, but, you know, you have to take my word for it.
I do. I do. It's the problem.
Good move.
It's almost like I wish they had sat on this case for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, okay, to at least create the appearance that there was enough time to do what they actually got done on it. The other thing, though, Your Honor, on that point, though, specifically, it really, the issue that I would really say is, it's really one of how much deference does the court actually owe to an opinion where maybe they worked on it early, maybe they didn't.
Listen to the implications of what you're saying. We get countless opinions or countless cases to review from the Board of Immigration Appeals, another instance in which there's an administrative agency and then an appeal directly, or it's a petition for review directly to the Court of Appeals. And the BIA has procedures in which they go through 120 cases a day. And sometimes you look at it and you think, boy, you know, how carefully could you have done this? And yet, I'm not aware of any doctrine, any case from the Supreme Court or any other court of appeals that entitles us to apply, let's just say, the kind of common sense question that you're trying to raise. We live in a world where we simply have to accept the work product of the agencies as their work product.
Could we go on to the question of whether the employee resigned because, isn't Augusta Bakery, along with Rose Printing and Medite of New Mexico, the beginning and end of the story?
So I think Judge Rovner is asking about Augusta Bakery and why doesn't that just dispose of this?
What I'm saying is, and forgive me for what I sound like, and it's very hard for me, is why are you asking us to ignore three recent cases in favor of a 40-year-old in a case of Mississippi Steel, which seems to be an outlier in any case? Did you understand a word of that, Mr. Kinney?
I believe I did, Your Honor. Yeah, I think it was. Why should you ignore Augusta Bakery in that line of cases in light of Mississippi Steel?
And the recent treatment and the way that Mississippi Steel has been understood in those more recent cases.
Right. Mississippi Steel goes to that's the equitable case. And that is Mississippi Steel was unique in and of the fact that what it did not do was sever that employment relationship. All the board said in Mississippi Steel is that that resignation that was submitted to the employer, I'm not going to consider it to have terminated the employment relationship. But what I am going to do is I'm going to apply equitable considerations and conclude that from that point forward, until the employer has other knowledge, we are going to toll any running of back pay. Okay?
But the board, in the opinion that it adopts, that the administrative law judge, this lengthy opinion, says that the backdrop of Mississippi Steel was somewhat different. Here we have a backdrop of a strike that turns into an unfair labor practice strike in March of that year.
Correct.
And that is seen to be a distinguishing factor.
Reinstatement rights would not terminate or be changed regardless of whether it's an unfair labor practice strike under employees have a right to be reinstated. Now, the timing of the reinstatement might change, but whether or not they have a right to...
Vis-a-vis replacement workers are different if it's an economic strike versus...
Absolutely. But the timing in terms of the right to be recalled or come back to work at the end of a strike, regardless of economic or unfair labor practice, that doesn't change. Under Laidlaw, an economic striker always has the right to come back to work. Under the unfair labor line of cases, they have the right to come back to an opening or to the place that is being currently held by a replacement worker. But even in this case, we actually had a rather interesting situation. We had a workforce of 70 employees at the commencement of the strike. By the time the strike was over, that workforce was down to approximately 40, some of those being replacement workers. And consequently, you didn't even have enough room for all of the unfair labor practice. And that's not a dispute, particularly in this case, but it is a fact that we have to look at in this case. The point that I would make, though, you know, here's the difficulty. And before we even talk about Mississippi Steel, right now we've got a situation where under these individuals resigned their employment. You can look at the record. I mean, it is absolutely clear. We've added it in there. Individuals would resign. I quit my job as of the moment you read this letter.
But the problem that I have with that argument is that it's too simplistic in a way. Everybody agrees they resigned. They resigned. Many of them for purposes of getting their hands in the 401k money. This is not the first time the board has seen such cases. And frankly, one doesn't even get into the world where recall rights are of any significance unless somebody isn't working there anymore on a day-to-day basis. You're not paying people on a recall list a salary. You're not paying their medical benefits. You're not paying their pension benefits. You're not doing anything. The most that a recall list does is it allows you perhaps to come in with your same seniority as you had before you left and the like. So what the board is asking is when they resigned, everybody agrees they resigned, was that at the same time an intention to abandon forever the relationship they had with KSM? And so by focusing on that abandonment issue, the board finds that many of these people, the people that we're discussing here, did not intend to abandon forever.
The problem you have with that is twofold. And number one, it goes to Mississippi Steel. How are you reasonable?
Answer Judge Rovner's question, then. Right. I don't think you can duck it.
How are you going to know? And because the other thing with Augusta.
It's easy to know, because if there's any question at all, you just offer them reinstatement. And if they say no, then you know they abandoned.
But the problem with that is under the 401k plan, you have an absolute requirement that no one can take a distribution from that 401k plan, except we're not going to get into the HPP.
I understand this. We have this whole issue about
Mr. Oxner, who never told any employee that he had the option of making a hardship withdrawal. He told them the only way to access funds is to resign.
I don't have the exact transcript site or appendix site in front of me, but that's not correct. As a matter of fact, there was one individual. There was one individual in particular, a Mr. Resch, who had originally been told that he would not be able to do a hardship withdrawal to cover medical premiums. They went back to the fund, and then the fund administrator then came back and said, "No, that is a permissible hardship withdrawal." They went back to Mr. Resch and said, "Yes, you can do a hardship withdrawal for that."
Is that anywhere in your brief, Mr. Kinney?
Yes, it is. It's under the section dealing with Alan Resch. I'll come back and give you an actual specific reference to that. And actually, that's a finding that the judge made, or the administrative law judge also made in his decision.
I don't think you're just – Judge Rovner could look at page 30 of Mr. Kinney's brief where Alan Resch is discussed. The ALJ talks about it, but the problem is most people were told by Mr. Oxner or pushed by Mr. Oxner to take that exit. And I still go back to the point – They did resign. They weren't employees of KSM, but they didn't intend forever to abandon KSM as a potential employer. They could have been recalled back to new employment, and that is not inconsistent, at least according to the board's line of cases. And I don't know if you ever asked the Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation or anybody else what they think about it, but I don't see anything that's non-bona fide about the resignation just because there might at some very vague point in the future be a right to recall.
And that is our point, because the regs require – actually, if you look, I did attach an information letter from the IRS to the reply brief. It's a letter addressed to Senator Sarbanes that actually discusses IRS's position on this issue, and it's exactly that. There must be a complete severance from employment in order for any distribution to be made from a 401k plan. There just is no exception.
It is determined that a separation from service did not actually occur, but a separation from service
that was
did occur for people.
These individuals resigned their employment. Now, you have the problem, though, is
they didn't intend to abandon the company altogether. They were hoping that there would be a chance to renew a new relationship. I don't know of anything in ERISA or IRS that says once you've quit a company's job, you are barred for the rest of your life from going back to work for that company.
Not at all, Your Honor. But then the problem you run into is, does that individual come back before someone else who has maintained their seniority under the collective bargaining agreement?
That's the whole point about a recall list. Those are people who are not working for the company but who still have this tenuous relationship.
And I think if you follow that line, Your Honor, you're exactly right, because what ends up happening then is this is not a zero-sum game. If one of these individuals drops out, then another person awaiting recall moves to the front of the line.
Yeah.
Okay? And so now what you've got to sit...
Sure, where you were going with that point. You make that point in your brief, too, but I don't think it's...
I don't understand this.
Remember what I said?
Why does that really matter?
70 jobs at the beginning, 40 at the end. Okay? If you are one of these individuals at the top of the seniority list and then you resign, and then... the person below you will move up to that next available stat, and that's where the point is. So
see, that's where I don't understand. I think you're making a mountain out of a molehill here. I think all you needed to do with these people who were pushed out the door by Mr. Oxner, who desperately needed their 401k money, you write them a letter whenever it is, 2 months later, 6 months later, in one instance, you know, many years later, and you say, a job that's substantially similar and that meets the various criteria has opened up. We're offering it to you, just like you wrote letters to some other people. And if they say, you know, I don't ever want to see the inside of KSM again, then you know they've abandoned the relationship. And some of them did say that. Some of them said, we have no interest in coming back.
Actually, 10 out of the 11 individuals that we're actually discussing, 10 of them, as we always said, did not come back. They had
could
jobs
have offered
in other
and been, you know, been facing a much simpler case, I guess.
It might have been a more simpler case to do it that way, but the problem is, how do you get around the fact that the board law is very clear that once you sever your employment with an employer, you are no longer entitled to recall? And there can't be any clearer evidence for this court to look at than a letter that says, you know, as of this moment, I resign my job.
But now, the board law says that maybe the letter is a piece of evidence, but it's not the only piece of evidence. There was lots of other evidence that the board looked at that showed that it was a more limited action.
And that goes to Judge Rovner's point in terms of why Mississippi Steel. Okay, Mississippi Steel is, of all of those cases, Augusta Bakery, Rose Printing, et cetera, that is the only... equity case, and all they said in that case is, you know what, the employer had this letter in front of them. They did not have any of this post hoc ergo propter rationalization coming from these individuals about, well, I resigned with my fingers behind my back and I really didn't mean it.
Forgive me, does it make any sense to try to distinguish that case? If the general idea is that an employer can't rely on a resignation that was made solely to procure benefits, and these people weren't told, except perhaps for Mr. Resch, that it would have to be, you know, that if that there was a hardship that they could be doing. I think I'm going to just quit. I just can't talk about
it. I didn't.
What she's saying is that it doesn't make any sense when the person has resigned solely to obtain the benefits, and with the possible exception of Mr. Resch, the vast majority of these people were never told that there was another avenue possibly available. And frankly, I will add, it's my recollection that in some of their cases, the hardship provisions didn't really apply. They weren't in foreclosure yet. They, you know, they saw themselves on the brink, maybe, but the
right,
hardship
their
provisions
were paying
if that is the question, again, we're confined and constrained by these plan documents. That's what our ERISA obligations are. Judge, you don't have any choice when it comes to these ERISA issues. There was the Kennedy versus DuPont.
Are you saying you don't have a choice to tell people that there is a hardship clause?
You do have, she says, are you saying that you don't have any ability to tell people that there is a hardship clause?
Actually, Your Honor, I think if you look at the appendix, you'll see in all of the plan termination or the payout requests, like RA 5 through 40, there are boxes that are checked for whether it's a hardship withdrawal, whether it's a rollover, whether it's a full payout on that. And again, every one of these individuals would have had not only the plan document but also the SPD. And I also think if you look at the record on this point, that when Mr. Oxner asked a number of these individuals, why do you need the money? The answer came back, none of your business.
Well, it wasn't his business.
Well, they were probably embarrassed. I'm going to tell you, if you have any other questions, Judge Rovner, feel free to ask them.
That's just too hard for me.
Mr. Kinney has run out of time anyway. I'm going to give him a minute if he's got a final word he'd like, but I will ask you to...
The only other point, again, I think that, you know, my issue with respect to the Treasury regs, the tax code, I don't think it could be any clearer, Judge. This is a situation where we need some equitable relief because we reasonably relied on these documents. The only other point I would make, and this is, I think, a very straightforward issue. In this case, the methodology of recall that the NLRB compliance officer adopted during this
proceeding. Have your briefs on that point.
With strict seniority. And again, I can simply tell you that that is not correct.
You've explored that.
Thank you.
Quite thoroughly in your brief, so I will certainly take note, as will
thank you, Your
my
Honor.
Colleagues, that it's a point you'd like to stress. All right. Thank you very much. Ms. Jin. This is Amy Jin from the National Labor Relations Board.
Good morning. Amy Jin on behalf of the NLRB. I want to start first by going back to the issue here of the remand from the D.C. Circuit and to note that not only is it true that a court will generally not look behind the agency's processes or when the agency makes the statement that they have considered, as here, the decision and record in light of the briefs and exceptions. In addition, KSM did not bring this issue to the board in the first instance, and therefore, under Section 10E of the Labor Act, this court does not have jurisdiction to consider that argument. The D.C. Circuit has also been presented with a similar argument in a case called New York and Presbyterian Hospital, and that court found in a similar situation that there was no jurisdiction, and that case is cited in our brief.
Okay. I mean, I would appreciate it. I think you did cite that. If you would move on to this point that Mr. Kinney has stressed so much about the ERISA regulations.
Certainly, Your Honor. We would say in the first instance that we do believe this case is guided by Augusta Bakery and the other cases dealing with resignations that are not abandonment. And that's really the key here, that resignation does not equal abandonment under board law. And as the judge found, even a cursory review of the board's precedent will show that. You cannot rely on a resignation made out of economic necessity to get benefits as an abandonment, that they are not the same thing.
So what's your response to the point that this may be labor law, but that under both pension law and tax law, this distinction that you're drawing between resigning from a job and thereby terminating an employment relationship and fully abandoning a job, I think it's fair to say Mr. Kinney says it just doesn't exist, that there is no room between those two concepts.
With respect to the ERISA and tax code argument, one thing that the judge relied on here, and that is clear, is in this plan that these employees were operating under, there is a provision, it's Article 6.4G, that says you can be reinstated to employment once you've had a severance, you can be reinstated to employment, and even continue to participate in the plan. So clearly the plan and the whatever ERISA regulations guided the development of the plan allow for the fact that an employee could take a severance distribution because, for instance, they've resigned or been terminated, and come back and participate in the plan, come back to employment. And
they just start de novo with the plan again as though they're a brand-new employee. Obviously, they don't have their account because they've cashed it out.
Right, and it's not clear what all the accounting pieces of that would be for the company, but it is clear that they can be reinstated, as at least one individual was here and as other individuals were offered. Mm-hmm. Another piece of this is that the company here did ultimately offer reinstatement to these individuals, sometimes far down the road, much after it should have been offered, but it was offered. And in that situation, back pay is the make-whole remedy for the unfair labor practice of not recalling them in the first place. And so once that unfair labor practice is found, that is presumptive proof that some back pay is owed. And in other situations...
I guess the company's point was that back pay would run only up to the date of the letter of resignation.
I believe that's what the company would
certainly
like.
Certainly argued that, right.
Certainly. I believe that's what they would like, but that is not consistent with board precedent. In only the Mississippi Steel case was there ever a situation, anything like that. And, of course, that was decided on a balance of the equities that the judge found just was not the same here. Because here you have a situation where the company encouraged facilitated and suggested to these employees that they might want to resign to get this money that they desperately needed. And that's just a much different situation than the one presented in Mississippi Steel. There are also other factors in this case besides the resignations. The resignations show that and when these employees resigned, they stated that they needed the money. They all stated it in one form or another, maybe not what they needed it for, but again, they made clear that they needed the money, and that's why they were quitting.
But let me ask you this question. There are two possibilities that I see. One of them is that a company in the position of KSM really just has to offer reinstatement to everybody, whether there's been a formal resignation or not, just to be safe and to avoid this problem that they now have. The other possibility is that there was some way ex ante at the time that the company could tell the difference between which people were going to have reinstatement rights down the line and which people were not. Which situation are we in, and if it's number two, what should the company have looked to make that decision?
Sure, Your Honor. Of course, the company could have chosen door number one, so to speak, and offered recall to everyone, and that would have been a safe position, as you stated. They didn't have to do that. They could have chosen door number two, so to speak, and decided to look at other factors as to whether employees had abandoned. Those factors are clearly laid out, for instance, in Augusta Bakery, in Rose Printing, looking at not did the employee sign a quit slip to get their money, but what other things happened here. For instance, in this situation, you have employees who got the forms that were circulated by the union saying who's interested in coming back, on their own got a hold of these forms and gave them to the company saying, I want to come back. You have a situation where an employee did come back, which is convincing evidence that they didn't intend to abandon. You also have a situation where they, for the most part, the employees who were working at interim jobs, which they had an obligation to seek out, were making much less money than before. And so not being in a substantially equivalent position made it much less likely that they would be abandoning their employment.
But would the company have known during that period of time that employee A is working for a working in a position that earns substantially less?
No, Your Honor. They would not necessarily have known that at the time. There are situations where they did and situations where they may not have. That is
I'm trying to put
true.
Myself in the position of the manager of the company and trying to figure out who do I need to send these recall offers out to and who do I have no such obligation toward.
The board standard is very clear that there is an obligation unless KSM can show that the employee unequivocally intended to sever their employment. So
would you say that anyone who really came and said, I desperately need the 401k money, is at least presumptively not a person who unequivocally wanted to sever?
I would say that, yes, that is what the board's precedent indicates in Augusta Bakery, which, of course, was enforced here, in Rose Printing, Medite. I would say that is where we're at.
That's one. Yeah, go ahead.
No, another point he made was, you know, how does the company deal with the lineup? You know, once you assume
sure.
they should be recalled, where do they fall in the list? What's your response to that?
Sure.
Are they given, in other words?
In this case, the compliance specification was set up using Strixey department by classification. And the board found that that was the most accurate method in this instance for recalling employees for a variety of reasons, including that in the first instance, right at the end of the strike, when originally people were reinstated, the company used the seniority method and has not been able to explain why they wanted to divert from that method later on when it was used initially. The board also
is the board also placing any weight on, I guess, this concept of restoring things as well as possible to the status quo ante? I'm sure, like most plants of this sort, it must have run largely on a seniority basis.
The judge did make findings that both before and after the strike, in layoff situations, that strict seniority was followed in those situations, including a layoff list that's in the record that was from January of 1997.
Was that in the old CBA that expired, or was it just practice?
There was a provision in the expired collective bargaining agreement governing layoffs, not recall from strikes, but governing layoffs, that talked about both seniority and qualifications. And the qualification provision in the CBA dealt mainly with I don't have the exact wording, but I know it's in the judge's decision, dealing with competence-type requirements. And one thing that the board found here is that by using strict seniority by classification, the general counsel was not saying that someone should have been recalled to a position they weren't qualified for, simply because they were only being recalled to positions that they had previously held.
Now, the language that the ALJ highlights in the contract on this, though, could be read to allow just a sheer assessment of the qualifications of an employee without regard to seniority and then to use seniority as a tiebreaker, which is what KSM said it was doing.
And what the judge additionally had to say about that is that the method that the company actually used here was not some kind of merit-ranked list based of figuring out who was qualified. Instead, another reason that the board felt that the company's method was not the most accurate was because it was a method that used unfettered and unverifiable discretion. It was highly subjective, involved when an opening occurred, people sitting around a table and saying, who's available, who should we bring back? And the board felt that, especially in the context of the unfair labor practices that occurred, and in light of Mr. Ushner's admission that without the unfair labor practice, they wouldn't have known. If things had followed the course that they should have followed in terms of reinstatement, who knows what their recall needs would have been as compared to what they ended up being. And because of all of those
reasons.
Labor
practice context is very important here, because actually putting to one side, you know, things like racial discrimination, et cetera, mm-hmm. if a company wants, you know, to throw darts at the wall to figure out who's going to work there, it would be a pretty silly way to do business, but they're entitled to do that. So unfettered discretion does exist, and so I'm not sure that in and of itself is a problem. It's just when you superimpose it maybe on the unfair labor practices.
Right, and that's certainly part of what the board looked at here was the unfair labor practices, the uncertainty that was created by the company not reinstating at the end of the strike when there was the unconditional offer to return.
Mm-hmm.
One more, if there are no further questions on that issue, one more point that to turn back for just a moment to the fiduciary obligation, the reliance in terms of the 401k resignees, the IRS letter that the company has brought up this morning, cited in their reply brief, was never cited to the board. So the board did not have a chance to consider that. The board has, in past situations, has ordered relief that could conflict with an employer's obligation under another statute, and we cite those cases in our brief, such as the natural gas and truck drivers union case, where an employer cannot engage in wrongdoing under the Act and hide behind the shield of another statute. And that's exactly what happened in the natural gas case. Even if the employer is going to face some kind of tax liability, they still have an obligation to follow the Act, and that's no different than what's occurring here. One more point, just with respect to some of the – there are several mitigation issues that have been fully briefed in this case, There is one case that was cited in the reply brief, Grosvenor Orlando Resort, that was not cited in the company's opening brief, and therefore we didn't have a chance to respond to it in writing. So I'd just like to say with respect to that case that the board did distinguish that case in this situation, saying that in Grosvenor you had employees who, after a strike, were sent discharge letters by their employer, and therefore the board said you need to get out and look for a job right away because you've been told you're going to be discharged. In this situation, however, 11 days after the strike, the company was sending out a notice, for instance, to Mr. Young saying, are you interested in coming back?
Well, they recalled him almost immediately.
Almost immediately. That's correct. Thank you, Your Honor. The board asked that its order be enforced in full.
Thank you very much. And Ms. Robbins.
Good morning, Your Honors. Marianne Robbins on behalf of Intervenor United Steelworkers. I would like to first explain to the court the context in which this case arises. In March of 1997, a strike at KSM converted to an unfair labor practice strike because of a number of unfair labor practices. Among those unfair labor practices were threats to the picketers that they would not get their jobs back, that they would never return to work. There was an unconditional offer to return to work on October 5th of 1997. At that point, the employer had an obligation to reinstate the unfair labor practice strikers rather than retain unprotected replacement workers. But they didn't do that. Instead, many unfair labor practice strikers waited 6 months, 9 months, as much as 6 years to get an offer of reinstatement. The reason there is back pay owed in this case is that the employer didn't follow the law and didn't offer reinstatement to unfair labor practice strikers.
But that obligation is qualified to a degree by whether there is a position.
Yes. And that, Your Honor, is the first point that I would like to address, the order of recall. Now, there's a deferential standard that this court is not trying to refine the facts, but is looking at the evidence, whether there was substantial evidence on which the board could make its determination. The board's determination in this case is that the most accurate way to recall employees was by seniority, plant seniority, within a classification. Now, that determination was based on the collective bargaining agreement that existed before the strike and which continued to be utilized after the strike as the basis for terms and conditions of employment. And that contract refers to seniority, and while it refers to qualification, it refers to a very specific objective standard for qualification, and that's found in Article 9, Section A, and it's discussed in the ALJ decision, which is in Appendix page 37. And what it says is that you are qualified, you are deemed qualified, if you can perform the work based on your training and experience in an efficient and workmanlike manner. It's an objective standard.
But I guess, interestingly, that paragraph doesn't use the word seniority. You don't get to the word seniority until the next paragraph.
But the point is that it's an objective standard that if you're in the classification, you've got the training and you've got the experience. And then on top of that, the party's past practice under this language before the strike and after the strike was that layoff and recall was by seniority within a classification. Plant-wide seniority, but only within a classification. There were exhibits that are cited, again, on page 37 of the appendix in the ALJ decision. Exhibit 2 and then 6 through 8, he cites to exhibits 6 through 8. They were actually charging parties' exhibits rather than the general counsel's exhibits. And what these showed is that when there was a layoff or recall, you went by seniority within a classification. That's the way it was done. And that's the way...
It's your position. I assume it's your position that even if there were maybe a couple of rational ways to look at the language that you're referring to on in the agreement, Article 9, Section 3B, that as long as the board chooses a rational way of looking at it, that's enough.
That's true. I'm also pointing out that in this case, the most accurate way to do it was by plant-wide seniority by classification. That's the way the compliance officer did it, and that's the way it was done. What the administrative law judge states is that the only documentary evidence introduced at trial demonstrates the use of seniority within classification as the basis for layoffs. The claim to the contrary is uncorroborated. That's
well,
the finding.
They started doing it after that first strike. I guess they brought some people back initially after the strike using the system you're talking about, plant-wide seniority by classification. But it was afterwards, right, that they started this open-ended system.
Yes, Your Honor. There are examples of where they followed plant-wide seniority, but what they did is they picked junior employees to come back instead of following their normal practice.
Mm-hmm. Or general factory instead of a more specialized person. Didn't they do that?
If you look at the examples I saw, they picked a junior person rather than, for example, Mr. Graff, who was on the picket line all the time. They didn't pick him, and they picked someone junior to him to return.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
what about this stockroom job for Mr. Weideman? When did that change from the closed to the open system?
Before, Your Honor, before there was ever a strike, and there was still work for Mr. Weideman. And what the ALJ found was that the staff person, that the supervisors were doing the work rather than Mr. Weideman after the fact, but that was not true before the fact to anything like that situation. I want to mention, in terms of the resignations, that there was, at the time that the strike ended, the employer sent questionnaires to employees, but not to those who had resigned. Nonetheless, the two individuals that a respondent has highlighted, Mr. Bannenberg and Mr. Resch, who resigned before the strike ended, got copies of this notice and sent it to the employer so that the employer knew that they had made a statement that they wished to be considered for recall within the first month after the strike terminated. And that you will find those notices in the NLRB's supplemental appendix, pages 52 and 53. There is no argument that the employer didn't know that these individuals wanted recall. They had written notice that they wanted recall. The others that are highlighted did not, in fact, resign until after the strike had concluded, and each of them should have been called back right away, given their seniority. And so in those cases, we've cited Coca-Cola bottling in our brief, and I noticed that the administrative law judge refers to Roman Iron Works. Those cases indicate that in this case, the employer has put themselves in a position where we can't tell what would have happened because they didn't offer people the jobs at the right time.
Okay, thank you very much. This is complicated, so Mr. Kinney, if you can confine yourself to a minute, I'll give you a minute.
Thank you. Very quickly, I'd like to address the seniority issue. Here's the finding of the administrative law judge at page 37. Respondents' witnesses asserted without rebuttal that this recall policy had been used in the past. That's the finding. And if you look at the collective bargaining agreement, it says exactly what it says. Now, would respondent have an obligation to say, look, this individual was qualified or was not qualified through those various factors? But, you know, you have to remember, that's what the company and the union negotiated and agreed to, that this would be the methodology. That was what the company and the union agreed to, and that wasn't one of the things that changed with this strike or that this strike was about. That's what we had agreed to with the union. Now, and the point that some of, or that the, at the beginning of the strike, the first people to come back were the highest seniority, that makes sense to me. Why? Because the highest seniority person in the department is probably the most qualified. Where it gets a little problem is as you drop down. And to Judge Rovner's question, specifically I would direct to the question with respect to the hardship withdrawal issue. Footnote 7 of the administrative law judge's decision, it's found at, page 1130 in the appendix, it's found, or in our appendix, it's found at A8. I recognize there are instances where employees' testimony shows Oxner did not discuss in detail why they were ineligible for a loan required by the employee because the plan doesn't provide it. But in many cases, he did. There's only one instance where an employee was misled at all. Oxner testified, credibly explained that he originally told Alan Resch that a hardship withdrawal could not be used for medical premiums. He later corrected that mistake. So I think that was a very specific question from the judge. And I would also point out, too, that Mr. Oxner did offer testimony at Supplemental Appendix 140, again, specifically how this recall. And this is important because it's going to change who gets back pay.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Thanks to all counsel.
Thank you.
We will take the case under advisement. Our third